great. Sensational. Terrific. What is it?
I told you.
Science. Crimeology.
Are you with me?
Not exactly with you, but somewhere nearby.
Oh.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and one morning on my way to work, I locked the front door to my apartment, checked out my phone and my wallet, and I walked down the hall to the elevator and I pressed the button. It was at that moment that I looked down to see my socks, and I realized that I'd forgotten to put on shoes. Now, if you'd asked me before that day if I would ever leave my house for work without shoes, I would of course said no, and I might have added that I would never do such a thing. So you can understand my concern that if I were to ask you, if you would ever click on a suspicious link or reuse a password, that the answer you might give might be similar and that you might believe that you, as a reasonable person, would never do so. But still, you might one day find yourself in the hall staring at your socks. Our guest today has been doing some fascinating research that looks at the relationship between our intentions, our behavior, and our risk of cybercrime victimization. Dr. Susanna van Hofterhoede is a postdoctorate researcher at The Hague University of Applied Sciences. She researches the human side of cybercrime and cybersecurity and has been doing some great experimental research into cybercrime prevention. Don't forget that we'll also be joined again by Dominic Vogel to answer my silly questions about the work of a cybersecurity consultant. But let's get straight into that first interview with Suzanne, as I'm always curious as to what it is that brings people to researching cybercrime. So before we get to talking about the research, I asked her how her journey into this elite community got started.
I started out studying psychology because I like human behavior and understanding why people do what they do. And immediately it became apparent to me that I'm not interested in general behavior so much as the really atypical behavior. So in my second year, I switched to criminology and I studied that throughout my master's. And during my studies, it became clear to me that I wanted to pursue this as a professional career, as a researcher, and I wanted to get my PhD. And since my master's, I've specialized in two completely different areas, and both happened somewhat by chance, actually. So the first was due to my supervisor being into the area of imprisonment and consequences of imprisonment for both prisoners and their families. And he was studying this in such a major project that he asked me to work for him as a research coordinator. And I was able to do my PhD on that topic as well. And that gave me a chance to explore this topic, which was really interesting. But after a couple of years, I started to notice that it took me farther away from criminology than I'd like. And it had a lot to do with family sociology, for example. And once I finished my PhD, I decided that if I could, I wanted to get back to criminology in its core. And so when I started to look for a postdoc position, this one opened up in cybercrime. And I thought, well, this is perfect. It's so central to current society. And, well, you couldn't be any more into criminology than if you're studying cybercrime. So I took a chance and Rutger Leukveld gave me a chance as a new researcher in the field. And it's been 4 years and I'm still having fun. And cool thing about our research group is that we're a combination of different backgrounds. So we had a researcher on the team that's a psychologist, and I came from criminology. And the combination of that is what led to this research that we did.
Is it easy to get along with the psychologists?
No, it's not. Not always. We tend to joke around a lot in the group. But no, I think we're all the better for it, combining the two fields. But don't let them hear me say that.
So you've done some research using a few different types of work, looking at behaviors and looking at attitudes towards cybersecurity.
Yeah, so two of the theoretical models that we've used are PMT model, which is short for Protection Motivation Theory. And the COMB model, which is short for a combination of capabilities, opportunities, and motivation. And both of these theoretical frameworks originate in psychology and have been applied to numerous kinds of behavior, but they hadn't really been applied yet to cyber behavior or online behavior. And we wanted to give it a go to see if we can predict how people behave online based on, for example, their knowledge of being safe online, the opportunities they have to behave safely, and also the extent to which they are motivated to protect themselves. And so we've used these theoretical models to create a questionnaire with all sorts of questions. And the cool thing there is that we were also able to include measurements of actual behavior. We tried to take the field a step further there to not only apply these models to cybercrime and cyber behavior, but also see if they hold up for actual behavior and not only for self-reported behavior.
So that's super cool, because you're testing the idea that people do what their attitudes and intentions say they will do. There's a whole set of research that's based around surveys and the theory of planned behavior, that people's behavior is sort of based on what they plan to do. But you're also actually testing to see if what they said they thought they would do and what they actually would do lined up. So do they do what they think they're going to do or what they say they're going to do?
Well, the short answer is no, definitely not. We actually found that the way people say they behave online has very little to do with how they actually behave online. There's very little correlation between the two. And that also does something to the theoretical models that we applied, of course, because what we seem to find in all these papers that we're writing on this topic is that these theoretical models may have been formed based on self-reported behavior. And then, of course, they do fit because, yes, people with more knowledge about being safe online seem to behave safely online. People who are motivated to behave safely online also report that they behave more safely online than others. But when we observe their actual online behavior, we see a very different story. And we see that motivation has little to do with actual behavior. And the same goes for opportunities. And the most striking of all is that knowledge doesn't actually seem to contribute to safe online behavior. So the people that we had in our research, the more knowledge they had, not only did they not behave any safer than the other people, they even slightly behaved a bit less safe. So it might even be that the more knowledge you have, perhaps you feel more confident about your abilities, or you are more confident about your estimation of the risk that is out there. And that might make you behave less safely.
So how did you actually go about doing the research? How did you compare what they said they would do against their actual behavior?
The cool thing that we did is that we took four types of behavior, and we both asked respondents how they would behave normally. So would you normally use strong passwords? Would you normally click on phishing links? Or would you normally download software from an unknown source? Would you normally share your personal information on social media? But before they were filling out these questions, we had actually already tested their actual behavior for these areas as well, without them knowing it. So we basically tricked them into behaving in a similar way than they would in reality in this survey environment. For example, what we did is we asked them to create an account in order to fill out the survey, which wasn't true, of course, but we wanted to see what kind of password they would choose, if they were warned that within the account, their personal information would be stored. And so due to privacy reasons, we're not able to see the actual passwords they chose, but we are able to see the strength of these passwords. The second experiment that we did, that was actually also pretty cool, because we told them that in order to answer some questions, they needed to watch a short video. And these respondents had done that before in different questionnaires, but in this one, the video didn't work. It didn't start. They received an error message, and then a pop-up appeared saying that in order to watch this video, they needed to download some software, which of course wasn't true as well. But we wanted to see how many of these people would agree to downloading this software, especially since in the download pop-up, we made sure to include as little information about it as possible, no known source. It wasn't a name of a software that anyone would have been able to recognize. So really, the only safe answer would be to not download the software. But quite a few people did. And the third experiment that we did is that in the end of the questionnaire, we asked them the standard questions that all questionnaires have, like, what's your gender? What's your education level? Are you married? Something like that. But then we started to increase the privacy value of these questions. So we asked, what's your address? What's your email address? What's the email address of a friend? And we ended with, what are the final three digits of your bank account? And of course, if you're thinking rational about it, no researcher should ever be asking you any of these questions. And they were able to click, I don't want to tell you, I don't want to fill out this answer. But quite a lot of people filled out their answers. And again, due to privacy reasons, we're not able to see what they actually filled out, but we are able to see who filled out many of these types of personal information. So this gives us information about these three types of actual behavior, and we're able to compare it to the questions that they answered about how they would normally behave in these three kinds of scenarios. And that's really cool data.
It's interesting. So I think there's two assumptions that we should question. One is that if people know more or are more aware, they are automatically more secure. And the other one is if they say they do particular security things, that they will do them all of the time.
Exactly. And you can even take it a step further and say that awareness campaigns might even be making people overconfident in their safety online and might even be negatively influencing online safety. All people would like to be able to protect themselves, but I think it's a huge challenge that many of us struggle with. I don't think you're stupid if you don't know how to behave yourself online. It's too much of a task to be able to do because there's so many layers to it, so many different factors to it. One of the lessons that our research shows us is that awareness campaigns are not the answer to being safe online, and that we need to go beyond awareness and figure out how to solve this puzzle.
And that research didn't stop there, did it? There was another stage.
Yeah. So after we were able to measure actual online behavior, we went back to these respondents a year later and asked them if in this year they had actually become a victim of cybercrime. And we looked at 12 different types of crimes that can happen online. And what, of course, we had expected is that people who had been behaving unsafely in the year before had a higher chance of having been a cybercrime victim a year later. What we actually found is that was very little relationship between these two. And this was, of course, very surprising because we thought cybercrime victimization is not all about personal characteristics. It's not about only about age or gender or education. And then we looked at, does it have anything to do with these routine online activities? And again, that doesn't seem to be the whole picture. And we thought, well, if we take a step further and we go into online behavior, there we will see that, for example, people who have weak passwords will have a higher risk of becoming a hacking victim. But again, we have to conclude that that doesn't seem to be the answer to this missing puzzle piece. And the current way we're trying to explain this to ourselves is that perhaps online victimization has, for example, less to do with your actual password. So in one account, is your password strong or weak? Maybe it has more to do with, has your password been stolen in a data break? And was that password the same one that you used for different accounts, for example? And the same goes with sharing personal information online. Perhaps being a cybercrime victim has less to do with the personal information that you share online and more to do with your personal information having been stolen in a large data leak. And that might be the way forward, that we don't look at particular behavior so much, but look at all these different kind of things that might be happening.
I can't help but think that there might be an unfortunate mismatch between the speed at which science is used to operating and the evolution of crime on the internet. Do you think there's any strength to the suggestion that the way that crime works online is evolving faster than our ability to make robust theories about how crime works online?
I think that might be the reality of social sciences in many cases. What we could try to do is not look at the specifics too much and go beyond that to see larger forces that are happening. For example, social engineering, that might be something that is influencing phishing, online fraud, e-commerce fraud, friend in need fraud. For example, in order to prevent this victimization from happening, we might need theories not so specifically focused on the crime that is happening, but the theoretical notions behind that, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I guess there would be some sort of very social or human aspects to how crime happens, like some part of the script for those kind of offenses that might not really ever change.
The interesting thing about crime scripts is that we can see all the steps that cyber criminals are trying to take in order to make victims and make money. And one of the things that we're trying to do with one of the researchers in our groups, Sifra Matthijssen, she's looking at ways that these cyber criminals kind of have to interact with their victims at least some of these points in the crime script, especially, for example, in ransomware. We see that, of course, you cannot make ransomware victims without interaction. And I think that is a way that if we are able to map what is actually happening step by step, that makes us able to put up roadblocks between any of these steps, create interventions. One of the things that is happening more and more now is that we're actually testing these interventions and seeing their influence on cybercrime offending and victimization.
Where do we go with implementations of, say, awareness and motivation type campaigns?
Well, behaving safely online and protecting yourself from cybercrime is, of course, very difficult to do if you don't have any knowledge about the topic. So I don't think that we need to end any type of awareness campaign immediately. I think we just need to be aware that we need to go beyond awareness and give people the tools that they need to protect themselves, but also make sure that they actually use these tools. We haven't figured out yet how to do that, but many organizations, both in the academic community and outside, are coming up with interventions, projects aimed at doing just that. And I'm trying to remind everyone that we also need to test their influence, because we all learned from, for example, Scared Straight a long time ago, that things can have a very different effect than what we thought they would. And the same thing can happen in cybercrime, for example, when you put at-risk youth together and train them to remain on the straight path. You need to be concerned with and think about the possible negative consequences such a meeting might have. And I think that is the way we need to move forward.
So making sure that metrics and measurement and analysis is included for all of these types of intervention, both for the ones attempting to reduce the likelihood of offending, but also for the ones that are attempting to reduce the likelihood of victimization.
Exactly. And if we know what works and we combine the things that do work and continue to develop the things that haven't been working yet, then we might actually reach a point where we are seeing less offending and also less victimization. Hopefully, because we've been finding it on both fronts in terms of preventing criminals from committing cybercrime and also making cyber victims or possible cyber victims more resilient.
What looks exciting for you now in terms of what you're going to be researching?
So one of the directions that I'm very excited about is combining explaining cybercrime with tackling it through interventions. So what I'm trying to do in my career is to do both studies that point towards these risk factors for both offending and victimization, and then either develop or test or both, interventions that are aimed at tackling these risk factors. And if we take that as sort of a route that we can take, then if we come up with actual risk factors that we have no doubt contribute to the risk of victimization, for example, then we can go to the drawing table, come up with an intervention that we think might tackle that risk factor and then implement it and test it. And if it doesn't work, we go back to the drawing table, come up with a different intervention and test that, or go back and pick a different risk factor and work at that. So yeah, my ideal goal would be in 10 or 20 years that we're seeing actual effects of the interventions that we're doing, and that also we're learning from each other and not all doing our own thing and seeing if that does anything, but continue to communicate with each other and help each other out, talk with different research groups throughout all these different countries about their newest findings and see if we can build on top of that.
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being a part of the interview, and I look forward to the research that you'll be doing in the future.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your invitation, and well, have a great day.
Now, if you're involved in cyber, you're often expected to answer questions on everything from why some monitors are curved to what the difference was between LimeWire and Napster. The best way to get ahead of those wild questions is to ask an expert, and we happen to have cornered a cybersecurity consultant. Dominic Vogel is a founder and chief strategist at Cyber.sc, a Canadian cybersecurity consulting firm, and a co-host of a weekly podcast called Cybersecurity Matters. Mr. Vogel is, among other things, a really nice guy who's willing to politely answer even my most inane questions. So let's take advantage of that and ask him this.
What do you do when you don't have the answer as a consultant?
You know, I think that's a key of a great consultant. And that's the approach we take with my advisory company, is that we're not going to BS our clients, you know. And one of the things that I remember from my corporate days, I remember working for a large consulting company, was that I didn't know how to help a particular client. And I went to the partner, and the partner told me to just Google it. And that really bothered me at the time, because I thought, you know, the customer is paying like a hell of a lot of money, and here I am, this junior person, basically just Googling an answer, and they're going to pay for that. And that stuck with me. And when I became an entrepreneur and I approached how I was going to build out our company values, one of the first things was that I wasn't going to BS our customers. If we didn't know how to do that, if that was something that we just didn't have the skill or expertise in, we were going to be upfront about that. And I've extended that further by, now, if we say we don't know how to do it, I make very certain that we know someone in our network who can. You know, I want to always be able to help our clients, regardless if it's directly or indirectly. I do believe in the power of helping them. And whether they reach out to us as a prospect and we never make a dime off it, but we introduce them to someone in our network who can help them, that's what we were set up to do, is to just help people in this field and help them when it comes to cybersecurity. And cybersecurity is such a complex domain, as you know, so many different areas of subspecialties. And like I said, we know what our main focus is on. That's generally at cyber risk leadership. But if there's things that we're not able to do, especially more of the technological stuff, we bring in people who we know can do it. But we never, ever BS our clients.
What's the most important thing to bring with you to a meeting?
You're asking darn good questions, Michael. To me, the best thing that we bring to a meeting, especially early on if they're a prospect, is bringing our authentic selves. One of the things which I pride ourselves on being is ruthlessly authentic. You know, our clients, prospects who become our clients, appreciate that basically who I am and who our team is basically what you see is what you get, right? We're not a bunch of fancy suits. We're not a bunch of people who hide behind facades. We are who we are. And that's why on sales calls, especially during the pandemic, I have my four-year-old on those calls, you know, and if that irritates people, if they find it unprofessional, then I don't want them as clients. Like, they can go elsewhere. They can go to my competitors. I find that by being our true selves, it allows us to attract the type of people and organizations that we can have very long, meaningful relationships with.
Once again, a big thank you to Dr. Susanna van't Hoftehoede for sharing that research. It really is fascinating stuff, and I couldn't agree more that the more we all communicate and share our discoveries, the better chance we have of solving these complex problems. Thanks as well to Dominic Vogel, and he and his four-year-old will be back next episode to help answer another question for us. But in the meantime, this has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only really made possible by the kind guests who share their time and their research. You can find out more about the show at cybercrimeology.com, or you could talk to me at @cybercrimeology on Twitter.